Hello, and welcome back to New Books in Music. I'm your host, Christopher Riggs. Today we'll be talking to Thomas Bay William Bailey about his new book, Unofficial Release, Self-Released and Handmade Audio in Post-Industrial Society. Thank you, Thomas, for joining me today.
Yeah, my pleasure.
I'd like to start, before we start talking about your book, if you could give us a little bit of a background on who you are and kind of how you came to write this book.
I guess around 2000, I graduated from Columbia College Chicago with a degree in creative writing and journalism, and shortly thereafter moved over to Japan, where, despite having kind of a non-career in music and, just dabblings in writing before that, that's, I think, when things really started to kick off for me, and the campaign of making myself interesting really began in earnest. And went over there, did some pieces for magazines like The Wire and just local sort of bilingual magazines intended to orient people to culture locally, while working as a sort of translator and proofreader on one hand and a ESL instructor on the other. And having sort of integrated into the subculture over there, I think really accelerated my interest in, I guess intermedia, you could call it, or, art forms that, not to be confused with multimedia, where, the focus is simply on having two or three forms and combining them, but, things that perhaps fall between the cracks of other fields of human inquiry,
right.
Maybe cannot necessarily be called a art or science or anything as concrete as that. And sort of focused my research in that direction, originally localized within Japan, but then further on, broadening my contact base to other countries and so on. And, at the same time, I was making music of my own. I guess you could call it kind of, psychoacoustic music or something like that, or an electronic music that's not necessarily either academic, just because it's not really done with the blessing of any particular institution.
Right.
Or, although, I don't know, it could be if I worked hard enough at it. It's just,
right.
That's a weak point of mine. Making it for myself. not necessarily that. And not necessarily dance music or more, popular electronic forms.
Right. Right.
And, in doing so, again, sort of ended up in this very tightly knit, but, very diverse circle of people who, work in that medium. Things just grew and grew over the years until, I had a sort of restless period of traveling, which, took me to Central Europe and to Scandinavia and, most recently to Spain in 2011, where I was a researcher in residence over there. I was invited by Francisco Lopez, the sound artist and bioacoustic researcher, to be the first, I guess, researcher in residence at the facility that he headed up there in a town called Murcia, which is called SOM. I forget what...
Right, that's what that stands for. Right?
Stands for, in Spanish, but SONM.ES is the, the website that they maintain for that. I've sort of been both a practitioner and a, just critic or documenter of the same kind of things. That being, technology that may not be necessarily used in a utilitarian kind of way, that's kind of a common thread with a lot of the, in particular, electronic music that I've worked with, be that, so-called glitch music or, you know, again, another kind of unfortunately named genre, but right. noise or you know, what's called Onkyo or New Berlin Minimalism or this kind of stuff. So, you know, I'm fascinated by, you know, people using very cutting edge technology to do things that are not necessarily aimed at, you know, I guess for lack of a better word, advancement, you know.
Right.
Things that are kind of, you know, either atavistic in nature or, you know, simply not done for the sake of perpetuating more technology, I guess.
Right, right.
So that's one definite focus of interest for me. And the other, which we're probably going to be talking about, is just alternative means of distribution for artwork, like, you know, mail art or networked art. Yeah, things like that. I'm sorry, did you have a question?
Oh, that seems like a perfect transition to specifically talk about your book. And you do insert yourself as a practitioner, you know, certainly at the very beginning and then at the end.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, to a much lesser degree than a lot of the other people in there. Okay. Because I may still have a bit of a perfectionist impulse to shake off. And you know, a lot of the people who are profiled in there, you know, it's not unusual at all for them to be doing something like 20 releases in a year
and
having it be almost like a magazine subscription sort of thing, really. There is a brief, I guess, sort of comical moment there in the beginning of the book where I'm outlining my early efforts as a child, I guess, in suburban Chicago there too.
Right Yeah, coming through punk rock and various other subcultures. I'm curious if you could talk a bit about the history of mail art and how that leads into cassette tape culture. It seems like a good starting point.
Yeah, there were not actually as many people who directly transitioned from that one culture to the other, you know.
Right.
In the beginning, I thought there were, but there was one person in particular I could probably point to, which was Rod Summers, who was sort of like a sound poet now in Maastricht in the Netherlands, who started, I believe, kind of on the cusp of the 80s. There was a project he started called the VEC Audio Exchange, which, you know, is probably as good an exemplar of the crossover as we're likely to get, where, you know, he had previously been working with correspondence artists and decided to, you know, just that the logical transition would be to, you know, put some of the things that they were doing on audio. And he was actually quite adamant early on that, you know, this project would not involve any kind of music. So, you know, it was really a sound by artists sort of proposition rather than a, you know, what could we call it, a musical one, although there was more of that as time wore on. But anyway, you know, obviously the history of mail art goes back much, much further than that. I mean, there's exemplars of that as early as the early 20th century, when you had the Italian futurists were, you know, sending metal postcards as artworks and things of that nature. And probably the one person that everybody points to, even though it's difficult to really have a single originator of something like this, where, you know, essentially everybody is refusing to be called that, you know.
Right.
Nobody actually wants to accept this honor because it seems, you know, so profoundly arrogant in the context of the work. It's a guy by the name of Ray Johnson who had the sort of a what was called a correspondence school in New York in the 60s. Which was deliberately misspelled. It was like correspondence, D-A-N-C-E, you know, which again was implying that there was this kind of, you know, a drama around the transitional act of corresponding itself rather than the final results, which was the interesting thing. And, you know, very much everybody I've interviewed from that culture says something to that effect. Like, there's another gentleman by the name of Andrej Tisma, Serbian artist who, you know, refers to his work as what he calls social sculpture, where, again, just the act of sending out various artifacts and getting reactions from them and seeing what that leads to next is more important than those artifacts themselves. You know, they're just this sort of propositional phase towards, you know, generating a response that, you know, is not necessarily directed or planned in advance.
Your comment about the male artists that none of them wanted to kind of accept this honor of being the originator. I'm reminded of the interview with Al Margolis where he's kind of dubbed this dubbed the grandfather of cassette tapes. Is that what the name that was given him in the conflict?
Yeah, I can't even remember who called him.
But then there ended up being a conflict with this group that because you had asked him. You know, whether or not he had any trouble with anyone that he was releasing. And he didn't really say that this was much of a conflict, but that was the closest thing to a conflict was something that was related to this idea of someone being crowned.
Yeah, and even then, who knows? I mean, that may have been just in good fun.
Right.
Just to, you know, goad him into doing something interesting rather than to provoke a little, you know, back and forth tiff via, you know, whatever zine they were communicating through at the time. Anyway, yeah, I mean, to answer the question you had earlier about how people transitioned from, you know, for example, doing xerography, you know, Xerox based artworks and that sort of thing to doing stuff on audio. It's hard to really say other than the fact that, you know, it just became democratized when, you know, high bias cassettes became available kind of in the end of the 70s. And, you know, it was just one more thing that could be affordably worked with and that people seized on. And it's hard to say there was really a more profound reason than that for people doing it. And, you know, again, these are people who have never defined themselves as artists in a single medium generally. So, you know, it was just another expressive form and often a very, you know, convenient one because now you could send people, you know, audio letters on cassette and also include a artwork or something as part of the same package. And I think, you know, from there we also, you know, sort of get the genesis of the, you know, these boutique record labels who specialize in custom packaged recordings, you know, which now are not just cassettes, but, you know, pretty much all the other recording media as well.
Right. And, going back to what you had, mentioned a moment ago about, this kind of not all that profound of a beginning with the, you know, availability of the, high bias cassette tape, that's sort of a thread that you trace throughout the book, the, how technology, kind of is involved in this exchange. But rather than get too into that, I'm curious if you could, as much as I would like to, I'm curious if you could maybe give our listeners, for especially those who aren't, well-versed in experimental music or maybe have never heard it before, kind of a brief introduction about what, you know, after this, the few transitionary figures who are involved in male art, who are doing things with cassette tape, with sound, but are explicitly calling it not music, into the people who, you know, eventually becomes industrial, post-industrial, and noise music, and all these other things. So maybe if you could quickly or not quickly, kind of maybe define or not define these things, or describe them.
Okay. Which should we start with there? Just, you know, experimental music in general?
Sure. Or? Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, it's always a tricky one because, you know, if we're speaking just in terms of results, you know, even, you know, pretty banal pop music could be experimental. You know, we have stuff where we these people probably had no idea they were going to generate 20 million fans or something like that on, you know, the strength of some fairly mediocre, auto-tuned vocal track. But, right. But yeah, I mean, in a more broad sense, I guess it would be a kind of music that really invites that, you know, that is really open to and not at all disappointed by the fact that there may be, unexpected reactions. But I mean, as for the lineage of this stuff in particular, it's strange because, you know, on one level, it was kind of an outgrowth of punk rock or something like that, or the very similar stuff that happened around the same time that I might call, like, you know, garage electronics, you know, just music very similar to punk rock and, you know, topical thematic content, but maybe done with, you know, synthesizers and something of that nature. So, you know, on one hand, that was an influence, but I think it was that way more so just for the, you know, the access principle that it embodied rather than any of the actual sound, you know. And in fact, a couple of people that I talked to did explicitly say, you know, they would be listening to bands from this period and sort of listening for what they weren't doing rather than what they were. And that was kind of interesting to me. So there was that. And then, you know, obviously the sort of John Cage school of, you know, indeterminacy in music, of, you know, inserting randomness into a program, you know, either to generate a composition itself or, you know, again, to generate a reaction, something like that. So, you know, this stuff that largely ended up defining the cassette networks and the stuff that followed it, you know, it had academic predecessors or, you know, so-called, you know, serious culture.
Right, predecessors or parallels.
Henry called it. Yeah, like, right. You know, Karlheinz Stockhausen or something like that. Again, there's kind of a offshoot of this that's very interested in psychoacoustics or seeing... Using sound, I guess, as kind of a observational tool, noting its effects on psychology and physiology more so than using it as entertainment or like something that's reflective of what may be going on around us. So, it's hard to bind all these things together,
right.
But you know, and there is sometimes crossover and sometimes not. But,
right. Right.
Those are, you know, just some of the things that I notice kind of dominating the conversation around all this stuff.
Right. And I do kind of appreciate your mentioning of, you know, the American experimentalism, John Cage, et cetera. Second, I mean, as important as
first chronologically, you know, but
as important as those things are, it is nice to have kind of cold water poured on things occasionally. You know?
So. Yeah, and again, you know, that's sort of become its own kind of formalism as well.
Right.
So you know, there's Cage and Cageians, just like anybody else. You know, where there's kind of these epigonies of the original that, you know, may not be advancing, you know, those ideas so much as I think they are. So,
right,
yeah,
right.
You know, that can be kind of codified as a school as any other thing can.
Right, right. Well, I wonder if, since we've started naming names, if we could, if you wouldn't mind mentioning a few kind of, I'd curious to hear you talk a little about Al Margolis, and I know we've mentioned him as the cassette godfather, grandfather. I don't know what I said, but if you'd like to talk about him or about anybody else from that time, one of the kind of the earlier people working with this type of music on cassette in the 1970s, 1980s.
Yeah. Well, another one who should definitely mention, who is, you know, sadly recently deceased, is Conrad Schnitzler. Mm. Who I believe it was a student of Joseph Beuys, actually.
Oh, that's right.
And, you know, obviously many were because, you know, Boyes had a open door policy where anybody who wished to study under him as a student could be, you know, and which was kind of a seen as a insult to the prevailing institutions there at the time.
Right.
But anyway, yeah, Schnitzler was involved with them and as well with, you know, a lot of the people from that so-called, you know, Kosmische music scene, you know, this sort of stuff like Cluster, I believe. Very, you know, ambient electronic music. And he used to do what were called cassette concerts, you know, where he would, I believe, have a belt of cassette players himself, you know, that would be turned on and on and off throughout a performance while also directing a audience who had come to participate in these shows who each, you know, had access to a cassette recorder and playback device of their own. And, you know, that was one of the more interesting examples of, you know, using the cassette not just as a medium of recording and distribution, but also as a, you know, a kind of harbinger of interesting new performances as well.
Right.
So he, I think, you know, in addition to doing all that, he, you know, hand painted a lot of his own releases and really had this strong emphasis on, you know, doing everything that he could within his own means or, you know, outside of actually manufacturing the recording medium, you know, which is something I bring up in the book that's
right,
been very
right.
difficult to do up until the time now where we don't have to do that, where, you know, we can record onto MP3 or other digital formats.
Right.
But anyway, Conrad was good friends with another friend of mine, Ken Montgomery, who is, you know, still active in New York and, you know, another person who has, you know, definitely acted as a node within this network because he had a space in New York called Generator, which was a combination of a gallery and like a boutique and a performance space all in one. And, you know, as unusual, or, you know, maybe, what do I want to say here? as unsurprising as that may seem now, you know, where there are more things like that available.
Right.
Something like that was really essential in furthering this culture that was, again, you know, largely based on communication across vast spaces and correspondence. And to have some place like that where you could indeed have a physical hub where people were coming in and, you know, maybe even meeting each other for the first time.
Right, right.
After, you know, months or years of correspondence or something like that, you know, it wasn't merely a, you know, glorified bulletin board exchange, you know.
Right, right.
Like Stahlplatt in the Netherlands was another one that was very similar. One in Germany called Gelb Music, I believe. But,
yeah, I'm tempted to, we'll talk in a little bit about how how much that has changed and hasn't changed
sure.
with the use of kind of net labels and labels continuing to use cassette tapes, even the ones who are releasing music that's recorded digitally. But I have a few things I was very curious to hear you mention because they were, again, things that were kind of traced throughout. They weren't kind of headline topics within the book, but they rear their head a few times.
Yeah.
And one of them is the let's say proliferation of varying political views that kind of
that's important, definitely.
Right, appear in the scene. I'm thinking of like the incident with Mark Solotroff and a few other things. I wonder if you could touch on that. I imagine there are some people who might be familiar with American experimentalism and and all of those things, they might be unaware of that aspect of kind of the underground tape network.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Well, again, I mean, going back to John Cage or something like that, if that is people's introduction to experimental culture here, which it often is, you know, people normally associate that with you know, Zen or, you know, as imparted by D.T. Suzuki or something like that. And, you know, just a generally more, you know, for lack of a better word, benevolent
right.
lifestyle. And, you know, the thing is that when we're dealing with culture where people do not have any other circuit through which to distribute it, you are going to get stuff like that, but you're also going to get stuff that's extremely hostile or misanthropic or, you know, just provocative in such a way that really nobody wants to dare touch it, you know, and, you know, obviously even record pressing plants aren't going to handle it. And, you know, thus we have to rely on things like Xerox covers and you know, music recorded directly onto cassette at home. So, you know, so from out of that, we get, as you said, a pretty broad spectrum of, you know, spiritual views, political views, what have you. And the one you're mentioning in particular, I think, involved a guy by the name of Mark Solotroff, or I forget what he was calling himself back then.
Right.
May have even been going by a pseudonym, Mark Saunderson or something like that.
Right.
But,
right.
But anyway, had a record label which was named, I think, after the AWB or the Afrikaner separatist movement in South Africa, and you know, it was rife with fascist symbols and you know, very you know, racially insensitive sort of subject matter. And anyway, they advertised in like the front page of a magazine called Electronic Cottage, which was put out by a guy named Hal McGee, who is fairly active still. And anyway, somebody had reviewed one of their records in that magazine in a positive light, and not necessarily agreeing with what they were saying, but simply saying they could agree how, you know, people in certain situations, you know, could end up adopting this kind of extreme mindset.
It was Jeff Jarman, if I'm remembering correctly.
Yes, right. Yeah, that was him, exactly. So, yeah, that started a kind of letters war and,
right.
You know, what seemed like, you know, what would have been just a, you know, footnote in the larger history of things, just, you know, expanded and expanded as they do.
Right.
And it's still kind of valid as a, you know, instructional point today, I think, where, oh gosh, let me get a drink here really quick. Hold on a second.
Sure. While you're drinking, not to interrupt you, but to take the opportunity while you're drinking,
sure.
I found it interesting the way that, again, Al Margolis is kind of set up pre-interview in the book, describing him as this kind of everyman who is just so kind of almost just possessed by the desire to keep dubbing tapes. And he runs this label. It eventually becomes another label. It sounds like, in the interview, he talks about how that's been parlayed into other lines of work along with larger record labels. But at the time he was, working a day job, and, he owned his own, cassette dubbing equipment, and he was dubbing all the cassettes himself. So he was contacting people through the mail or people he had met, and often people who ended up being fairly well known in the experimental world, Jim O'Rourke, I think, one of them.
He was one.
But he's kind of described as someone who's just, I don't want to say apolitical, but is certainly in his artistic practice that it's much more focused on kind of the consumption and production of sound. And setting that kind of his longevity up against, some of the more, you know, like an insensitive kind of content of the other ones, and the lack of
longevity.
That's
a very good point, too. And I mean, even for, you know, sonic extremity, if that's the only criteria we're going by, I mean, there's compositions by like Yanis Xenakis that are just mind-blowingly more intense than you know, some of the garden variety power electronic stuff is out there, you know. And
Well, as you
know, obviously he had more resources to deal with, but still, you know, there's this drive there that is absent from even a lot of the stuff that's supposed to be the most extreme music ever recorded. And
right.
Having said that, I mean, these labels or single artists that kind of fixate on either representing a single genre or attitude, I find that within this culture, they're not nearly as resilient as these people like Al, you know, who really, you know, again, are obsessed with being documentarians and I think trying to get the most accurate portrait of, you know, human expression that they can. And, you know, that takes them very far afield. So,
That seems consistent with the way that you've described the male artists, and that they're not, you know, dependent on a particular medium. That they're interested in, I guess, a kind of sociability, right? That interaction, that exchange of kind of holding up a network is the most important thing, or one way of describing a very important thing, rather than call it the most important thing. But since you've mentioned it, towards the end of the book, you talk about net labels and one type of net label, which is what you had mentioned, the labels that kind of specialize in that particular type of potentially offensive content and often maybe spend more time focusing on coming up with titles than they do on the sounds themselves. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about net labels and what I think. This must seem even more bizarre to people who aren't kind of initiated into that scene than, like, I think I ran for several years a cassette tape label, and that was difficult enough to explain to someone who wasn't involved, but it made sense once they knew that I was going to the post office and selling things through PayPal and all that. But a net label seems very what if you could offer a description of that?
Yeah, I mean, it's a fairly recent phenomenon, so I don't think, I think people are beginning to catch on to it, but it's amazing how little space you see covered in, you know, even magazines like Wired or something like that.
Right.
I don't read that regularly, but I can't remember ever seeing anything in there about net labels or a similar phenomenon. But anyway, yeah, I mean, as the broadband internet era really kicked in, you know, that allowed for the, you know, much quicker dissemination of things on, you know, immaterial music formats, whether it was MP3 or FLAC or whatever other format people preferred, you know, what type of compression algorithm they liked. But, after a while, I found it interesting, you know, before even, or at least at the same time that stores like iTunes were a going concern, that you had people who, you know, were active previously with burning things onto CD recordables or onto mini disc or some other, you know, available format like that. You know, they're maybe converting their catalogs over to MP3. Like there's one called Zero Moon, which I believe still does that.
Mm.
So on one hand, there were entities where they were simply taking what they already had and making it into a digital archive of sorts. And, you know, people, you know, there are different methods of receiving it. Sometimes it was completely free, or sometimes it was kind of a pay what you want sort of deal. But gradually there have been more and more labels cropping up where they don't even have to rely on that that back catalog. You know, stuff is solicited directly from, or fresh work, you know, is solicited directly from artists. And it's another one I could land upon here.
Well, there are It seems like in the book you describe you give the ones I've already mentioned, the ones who are kind of engaged in almost a form of trolling a little bit mentioned towards the end of that part of the book. But then prior to that, you do talk about a few who do kind of maybe Zero Moon was one of these, who do a similar kind of engagement with technology where they're very interested in the limitations and the ways that the MP3 itself works. Maybe you could mention, I don't remember the names of those.
Well, they're...
you might not either. I wouldn't.
Again, it's been a long time since I've even went back and proofed that text. But yeah, the ones you're talking about in particular to specialize on releasing things that are on low bit rates.
Right.
You know, stuff that's... anybody can go into iTunes or a similar program themselves and just say, I want to convert an MP3 over to, 8... KBPS or something like that, and strip a lot of the sonic quality from it. And I guess there were some people who realized that's a way to create interesting sonic artifacts all on its own. You know, you have this very distinct kind of melancholic tinny sound or something that comes from doing that. But also, there's a lot of these labels that have been proliferating in, places like the former Soviet Union, where this broadband internet has yet to arrive in full, or, to the same degree that it does over here. And people who want to promote their work, the only way they may have available to do that is through getting through to people at net cafes or something like that, who the meter's ticking the second they walk in the door, and they do not have 2 hours to download a single song. And, so that may be a way of getting around these limitations for people within these countries. But again, it's this combination of both an actual desirable aesthetic on one hand and contingency on another. Sometimes the two meet, sometimes they don't, but it's certainly an interesting thing. And obviously another thing that's kind of followed up from the glitch music, or kind of intentionally engineered digital failures that started becoming more of a going concern in the late 90s and early 20th century through record labels like Amigo or Falsch and so on.
Right. Now I'm remembering, I think the Net label in particular that kind of stuck in my mind was the one that I believe the limitation was had the same number of megabytes as the floppy disk, and that was the restriction.
Oh, yes. Right. Yeah, right. And I think some of these things were actually released onto 3.5-inch floppies again.
Right, and I still have I've never been able to... I think something went wrong with it, but I actually have a release that was... A friend of mine gave me that was released that way, and that dates me a little bit generationally.
I had them too,
I'm curious about if you would be willing to talk a little bit about your own participation in the scene. That's mentioned a little bit at the end. I believe it was the Tapeworm label. And I was thinking about in that last, maybe the second to last chapter, the one that talks about kind of the resurgence of cassette tape culture and within experimental music. And you had mentioned the Tapeworm label, and I thought, oh, Tapeworm. I have a release on Tapeworm, and then I realized that, of course, there was more than one label called Tapeworm.
For the one that's in that book is they make very careful to say that they're not an offshoot of it, but they're really closely related to the UK label Touch.
Right.
Very seminal kind of sound arts label over there. And... That's mainly because originally they drew on the same roster and everything. It wasn't really a matter of Touch being a parent label. But a lot of the same people were involved. And the whole thing with things still being available on cassette now in the 21st century, when people have to go out and actually buy equipment and hunt it down on eBay or something, in order to play these releases. A lot of people will think that that's just completely contrarian and you know, just another means of being more difficult or something like that. But even within that criticism, you know, there's a bit of truth, but maybe not so harsh and condemning as that. You know, I think there's something to be said about people coming to the artists themselves and not allowing themselves these conveniences of, you know, for example, just skipping to the next song in a program, or, you know, as we have with MP3s now, just programming things in the order that they like when right. they have a listening experience ahead of them. And, you know, cassette is kind of one of the more demanding media in that manner, that you have to just, if you do attempt to skip ahead to something, you know, it's going to be kind of a trial and error process to get where you want to go. And more so than CD or whatever, it kind of requires people to buckle in for the duration, as it were. And, you know, that's one thing that actually did contribute to my getting interested in it. I wasn't initially, but the sort of work I do is kind of a slow-burning sound that relies on fairly steady crescendos and decrescendos, and it just seems to mesh well with the, I guess, the slowness of that medium, you know, where just watching these tape spools slowly churning away as you go, and the overall, I think, speed of people's reception to the music was congruous with actually putting it on cassette, you know. And again, you know, a lot of other people have had motives similar to that, or more involved with just kind of a fetishization of it, or a ironic appropriation of it, if you would. But yeah, again, right. everybody is seemingly different there. What's that?
Right. And I mean, the you described, I think, I believe it was Conrad Schnitzler who was one of the earlier people to use cassette tapes in performance, right? He was the one with the belt of cassette,
yeah.
right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the way that you're describing kind of, you know, post-MP3 cassette tape listening is itself a kind of performance that has these limitations mm-hmm. to it. It's kind of interesting the way it's full circle like that. I mean, that was always my... my motivation to be involved in it as well, that it didn't have the same kind of it was nothing like iTunes. It was nothing like being able to click through something on an iPod. I was unable to even tell how far along I was. I mean, some of these cassette tapes they're spray painted over. I can't see how long the cassette is. It could break halfway through.
Yeah, your auto reverse on or whatever.
Right.
That was got
right.
Yeah. But if I can actually cut in before I forget it,
sure.
there's a release by Daniel Menchie, the Portland-based sound artist, in there where. In order to even get to the cassette to begin with, it was between these two sheets of metal that were bolted in such a way it required power tools to open it up.
Right, right.
So again, you're being required to participate in just this kind of performance in which, you know, commitment is resurfaces as a value. And, you know, if, you know, the theme of the music is sort of hard work or industriousness or something like that, it's, I found it quite clever to do something like that where you actually is further dramatized by you having to labor away and
right.
even getting to the recording to begin listening.
Right. But before we start to wind down, I did want to ask about I can't remember his name. The cyberpunk author, mm-hmm. multimedia, or sort of the one who ended up recording a number of CDRs. I cannot remember his name. I'm sure you know who I'm talking about.
Maybe Kenji Shiratori.
Who, yes.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
What if you could? I had never. I mean, so many of the I was familiar with Al Margolis and Merzbal, obviously, and many, mm-hmm. I'm sure many people who would be interested in reading the book would be familiar as well. And maybe they would be familiar with this particular artist, but I had never heard of him. And mm-hmm. it was very interesting, kind mm-hmm. of very interesting story.
Kenji's, I don't even know. I still don't even know if he's actually human or
right.
you know, generated experiment, even though people have claimed to see him like at acousmatic music festivals and this kind of thing where he's been booked. But he wrote a book, again, kind of a cyberpunk word salad sort of book called Blood Electric, and supposedly it was acclaimed by David Bowie and all these other people,
right,
but
right.
The press quotes are not really verified in any way.
Right.
I don't know. That's a story all unto its own. But anyway, he had this really kind of exasperated style in which, sentences were just kind of strung together that didn't really have a lot of, what do I want to even say? You know, they didn't really seem to have subjects or anything like that. The objects were present, but subjects weren't there. And it was all this very sort of techno-gnostic sort of hallucinatory prose. And anyway, he decided he wanted to, at some point, do readings of this kind of stuff to musical backing, and solicited pretty much like every single person he could think of, you know, I guess, within the, you know, the sound arts or post-industrial music underground to collaborate with him. And a lot of people were quite flattered by this. You know, his means of introducing himself to them was not just to send out a, you know, hi, would you like to collaborate me email, but he would send a review of something that he had heard of that artist
right.
in this sort of panicked, short-circuiting style, you know, of his again. And so anyway, out of this, you know, managed to get a harvest of dozens and dozens of recordings, but the catch there is not just the fact that he became as prolific as, you know, some of the other people in Japan, you know, like Merzbau or somebody like that, but it was that suddenly people were realizing that recordings they had sent in, you know, for collaboration were being used under different names or being attributed directly to him,
right.
or being put in this huge pool of raw data that he would misattribute or something like that, and managed to get quite a few people angry, and right. you know, especially when and where royalties were actually involved. I don't know how many times that was the case,
right,
but
right. Right.
you know, again, raised a very interesting question that I may still not have the answers to about you know, the role of communicating with complete strangers within these networks, and of no, these occasional breaches of trust that you
right.
know, still do occur even in a very often utopian environment like this.
Right. Yeah. And I reading that portion of the book, it and knowing kind of the time period that took place, if I'm correct mm-hmm. in assuming that it seemed almost like he was that if he had existed earlier, it wouldn't have worked. Mm. It would have required for him to kind of pull that kind of thing. He would have had to have so much more resources and time to actually send things through the mail. And in a way, it would be a more impressive feat if he were to do that.
Yeah. But no, I mean, he has the excuse that he's just kind of making a comment upon the, you know, digital zeitgeist
right.
or whatever,
right.
where, you know, that he is raising questions about anonymity and viruses and so on, you know, and that kind of conversation again didn't exist originally,
right? And it almost seems like it couldn't exist now, several mm-hmm. years later, that it's
yeah.
almost like it's played out, or it's too easy,
I think, so
to do something right. 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 Well, I'm as we're kind of winding down, I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about you know, what you're working on now and what's mm-hmm. What's next.
Okay, well, major thing I'm doing right now, which happily does have a publisher, but just to respect their wishes, I'm not going to say who it
sure,
is yet.
Sure.
Yeah, because they, I think they're planning a series of books, and they don't want this to be fully public until that's all
right.
Set in stone. But anyway, I'm going to be doing a book that's about the cultural history of synesthesia, which, you know, if people aren't familiar with that, that's a process where one sensory input gives you two simultaneous sensory outputs. You know, so if you hear a sound, you're going to translate that as a color in your brain or something. And there's been, you know, quite a lengthy history of this over, you know, not just the past couple centuries of Western culture, but also in, you know, archaic history. And I'm, you know, very fascinated by, you know, not only the successes in this area, but the very intriguing failures as well, you know, because it's very, very difficult to get a universal one-to-one correspondence between a sound and a vision, or, you know, even a sound and a smell, or, you know, any two combinations of sensory data. Mm. So it's, and also, you know, a very, very limited number of the overall human population are clinical synesthetes. You know, there right. are people who can train themselves to make metaphorical connections, but the people who have the inability to turn that off at any time is very, very limited. So we can't really speak about synesthetic art so much as about what we'd call cross-modal art, you know, where, you know, you're attempting to make an illusion of those connections, but it's not always going to be a perfect match. But anyway, you know, that's something I've been working on since, you know, at least the time I went over to Spain to do a paper on that. And slowly building, and I'm almost finished with it. And, you know, again, should be released in 2014 or so. I also have a couple books out now or forthcoming. There's one in Germany called Urban Klangräume, or Urban Sound Spaces, in which I'm talking about, you know, an attempt to make a kind of techno-organic hybrid sound environment for, you know, the new mega cities that we're living in. There's that. There's also a book that was curated by Zbigniew Karkowski, the electronic composer. It's called Order is an Exception, and I have a piece in there. There's also Curtis Rhodes, the granular synthesis, I guess we could say proselytizer.
Oh, or, right, right.
You know, innovator. There'd be more.
Right, right.
Nicer.
Right.
Yeah, that's what I originally meant to say, yeah. He has a piece in that. There's a few other, you know, people from the sound arts community who have sort of put this collection of texts together, not just as a tribute to him, but as a, you know, sort of furthering of his own ideas. So there's another few things where I have some input. And other than that, I am working on a series of recordings, which is called Thank You for Your Interest. They're basically limited edition of one made-to-order recordings in which I have a hand-designed box which contains the single copy of the commissioned recording and, you know, some other digitally generated artworks. And I was just instituting that as a means of getting out of my rut and seeing what other, you know, what other modes of expression I can be forced into once people do set limitations upon me, because that's not something I was very familiar with. And, you know, wanted to see if I could, you know, take the old style system of arts patronage and, you know, modernize that somehow, or make that something truly personal. So
right. Oh, very interesting. Well, I very much hope that when your book on synesthesia comes out, that you'll talk to us at the New Books Network.
Yeah.
We'd love, yeah, to, love to hear about it.
Definitely love to do it.
Great. Well, thanks so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
You've been listening to a conversation with Thomas Bay William Bailey about his new book, Unofficial Release, Self-Released and Handmade Audio in Post-Industrial Society. I'm your host, Christopher Riggs, signing off.